Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're diving deep into private equity today, specifically these capital commitments you hear about. What are they? Why do they matter? And how do they impact you as an investor? We're going to break it all down.
These commitments, well, they're essentially pledges. Institutions and individuals promise capital to these private equity funds.
It's the fuel that gets these funds moving, right? Allows them to go out and invest in companies with high growth potential. We've got some research papers here. One in particular by Gourier, Falapu, and Westerfield really digs into the nuances of these commitments. And I'll be honest, some of their findings were pretty surprising.
Yeah, there's a lot more to capital commitments than you might initially think. It's not as simple as parking your money and waiting for the returns. It's a lot more dynamic than that.
Right, it's not like a savings account.
Exactly.
So let's start with the basics. For someone who's maybe not familiar with private equity, what are the different ways institutions can actually invest in this world?
Okay, so think of it like choosing your dining experience, right? You've got a few different options. First, you've got the blind pool fund. That's kind of like opting for the chef's tasting menu.
Okay, I like that analogy.
You're putting your trust in the fund manager's expertise to select and manage those investments, even though you don't know exactly what they are beforehand.
You're trusting the chef's culinary instincts.
Exactly.
Interesting. So you're placing your faith in the fund manager's ability to pick the right companies, nurture them, help them grow. What's the main advantage of choosing this blind pool approach?
Well, access is a big one. Top-tier private equity firms, they often have this like exclusive access to deals that you wouldn't find elsewhere.
They've got the inside track.
Exactly. And they've got a whole team of experts who can do that due diligence, negotiate terms, things an individual investor might not have the bandwidth or the network to handle.
So it's like you're tapping into their expertise.
Exactly.
You're tapping into their network. Okay, what about the second option? You mentioned going solo. What's that all about?
Right, so that's the solo investment. That's like, cooking at home. You're handpicking the companies you want to invest in. You're managing the entire process. You've got complete control, but
It's a lot more hands-on.
it is. It demands a lot more expertise, a lot more resources, and often, frankly, it involves more risk.
Yeah, it's like starting your own gourmet restaurant. You need the skills to match. Okay, so we've got blind pool, we've got solo. What's the third option on this menu?
The third option is the discretionary vehicle. That's kind of like hiring a personal chef. They'll present you with, curated investment opportunities based on your specific criteria, and you decide whether or not to invest. You have more control than a blind pool, but you still get the benefit of expert guidance.
It's a nice balance. Okay, so we've got our three options. Now, our research shows that blind pool funds are by far the most popular, like a whopping 93% of the private equity landscape. Why do you think that is?
Well, for one, those specialized intermediaries we talked about, those with the expertise, those connections, they're largely managing these blind pool funds. They're the ones with the experience to navigate this world.
They're the seasoned chefs in the kitchen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, research, like the work by Axelson, Strumberg, and Weisbach, suggests that these commitments, they're not just about providing capital. They also play this really crucial role in managing risk.
Now that's interesting. So you're saying commitments, which seem to tie up capital, actually help mitigate risk. How does that work?
Well, think about it. Private equity fund managers, they're incentivized to deliver those high returns, right? But there's this theoretical risk. You see, with limited liability, there's a chance they might be tempted to, I don't know, maybe oversell an investment to attract investors.
So there's a potential disconnect between promises and reality, especially if there's not much skin in the game for the fund manager.
Right.
Okay.
But when investors make those upfront capital commitments, it's a strong signal.
A signal of what?
It shows trust in the fund manager. It says, we believe in your ability. We believe in your strategy. This trust, it allows fund managers to negotiate better deals, take calculated risks, and really focus on long-term value creation. They know they have that committed capital behind them.
It's like giving a vote of confidence to the chef. You're saying, I believe in your vision. I'm willing to wait for that incredible meal, even if it takes a while to prepare.
That's a great way to put it. It's a two-way street. Investors demonstrate commitment, and fund managers can operate with that longer-term perspective.
That makes sense. But let's be real, this isn't like ordering takeout, right? Our research indicates there's usually a significant time lag. We're talking around 3 years on average between making the commitment and actually having to hand over the cash. Why the long wait?
Well, that lag is a crucial element of private equity. Unlike, say, stocks, which you can buy and sell quickly, private equity investments, they take time to mature. It's not just about finding the right companies. It's about working with those companies, helping them reach their full potential.
It's more than just finding the right ingredients, isn't it? It's about understanding them, crafting them into this refined dish, right?
Exactly. It's a process.
You're doing due diligence, structuring deals. They're working with those companies. They're helping them refine those operations, implement growth strategies, really maximize that value before they even think about an exit.
You got it.
Yeah.
And that value creation process, especially in private equity, it's not about those short-term gains,
yeah.
right? It's often about strategic shifts, operational improvements. Sometimes it's even a complete overhaul of the company's business model.
Wow.
And all of that takes time.
Yeah.
And it's during this phase that experienced private equity managers, they really earn their stripes.
So that three-year gap, that's where the magic happens. That's where a promising startup, you know, with the right guidance, can transform into a real market leader. But this whole commitment thing, it's not without its challenges, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Gourier, Fallopoux, and Westerfield, they dug into one particular challenge in their research. They called it commitment quantity risk.
Commitment quantity risk. Okay, that sounds a little intimidating. What does that mean for, you know, the everyday investor?
All right, imagine this. You commit, let's say, 10% of your portfolio to a private equity fund. Then, boom, the market takes a hit. Maybe a 30% drop. Totally unexpected.
Ouch.
Suddenly, that 10% commitment, which was based on your portfolio's value before the drop, well, it represents a much bigger chunk of your assets now, right?
Yeah, because your portfolio is smaller.
Exactly. That mismatch between your initial commitment and your portfolio's adjusted value, especially during those volatile times, that's commitment quantity risk.
So it's not just about the time lag. It's about how that committed capital as a percentage of your portfolio can fluctuate with the market.
Exactly. And that's a key point.
Okay.
That's precisely why the researchers found that investors, they place a high premium on flexibility. They'd rather accept slightly lower returns if it means having more control over adjusting their commitments down the line, especially when the market gets bumpy.
Yeah, that makes sense. Being able to adapt to those changing conditions, that's valuable for any investor. Let's talk about those capital calls for a moment. We've committed the funds, right? But what happens if we get a call and we're, well, a little short on cash at that moment?
Well, that's where things can get a bit tricky. See, in the world of private equity, defaulting on a capital commitment is something you really want to avoid.
Okay, so let's talk about the consequences. What are the implications if you can't answer that call?
The penalties, they're usually spelled out in the limited partnership agreement. And they could be pretty harsh.
How harsh are we talking?
We're talking potentially forfeiting your entire investment in the fund.
Wow.
You could lose out on any future returns. And it could even hurt your chances of investing in other funds managed by that firm down the line.
So it's kind of like getting blacklisted.
In a way, yes. And in some cases, there might even be legal ramifications.
Okay, yeah. That's serious stuff. I can see why defaulting is pretty rare.
It's a tightly regulated space. Upholding those commitments, it's crucial for maintaining trust within the whole private equity ecosystem. Investors, fund managers, they all understand how important it is to honor those agreements.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. You look back at the 2008 financial crisis. That was a real test for the private equity industry.
Yeah, that was a wild time for everyone. What were some of the ripple effects within private equity?
Well, as markets were, you know, plummeting, a lot of investors, they suddenly had these capital calls at the worst possible time. Liquidity was scarce.
Oh, boy.
It became a mad scramble to raise those necessary funds to meet those obligations.
So even with that long runway, those unexpected market events, they can create real liquidity crunches. What were some of the ways investors tried to navigate that challenging environment?
Well, some institutions, they had to make really tough choices. Some were forced to sell other assets, even at a loss, just to meet their commitments to their private equity funds.
Wow.
Others resorted to borrowing, often at less favorable rates, to bridge the gap. It really highlighted the importance of managing liquidity carefully, especially when you have a chunk of your portfolio tied up in illiquid assets like private equity.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that even with those long time horizons, private equity investments, they're still part of that broader market context. They're not immune to those fluctuations. So we've talked about the commitments, the capital calls, the potential downsides, but what about the upside? When a private equity investment is successful, how do investors actually see those returns?
Good question. So distributions, that's what they're called. They're typically triggered when the fund manager exits an investment successfully, maybe through a sale or maybe through an IPO. It's the culmination of all that value creation we were talking about earlier.
So it's not like receiving a dividend check every quarter. It's more about waiting for that fund manager to execute their strategy to unlock the value of those portfolio companies.
Precisely. And because these investments aren't as easily traded as public stocks, there's naturally less liquidity. But, and this is important, that doesn't mean investors have no options. There are ways to manage those positions and potentially access some liquidity before a full exit. That's where the secondary market comes into play.
The secondary market. Okay, for those who might not be familiar, what is that exactly? What role does it play in private equity?
Think of it like a marketplace.
Yeah.
Investors, they can buy and sell stakes in existing private equity funds.
Yeah.
It gives them a way to potentially liquidate their holdings, you know, before a fund reaches maturity. Provides some flexibility.
So it's like a pressure valve.
Okay.
It lets investors manage their exposure to private equity based on, well, their individual needs and their own liquidity. But if it's so valuable, why is the secondary market relatively small? I mean, compared to the overall size of the private equity market.
It's a good question. One reason is simply the nature of private equity itself. These investments are inherently illiquid.
Right.
And their valuations, they can be more complex than, say, your typical publicly traded stock. It's not always easy to find a buyer or a seller who agree on the price. And transactions, they can take a while to negotiate and finalize.
It's not as straightforward.
It's not like clicking a button and selling shares instantly on the open market. It's more nuanced, more specialized.
Okay.
And then there's the pricing aspect. Because the secondary market is less liquid, sellers, they often have to take a bit of a discount.
A discount.
Yeah, a discount to the net asset value of their holdings. They might not get the full potential value of their investment if they choose to cash out early.
It's that trade-off.
Exactly. Liquidity versus return.
Right, right. But here's something I found interesting in our research. It seems like a lot of these secondary market transactions, they involve investors selling their whole stake in a fund, not just a portion of it. Any idea why that is?
You've hit on a key point about the structure of the secondary market. Remember those specialized intermediaries we talked about earlier?
The chefs, the experts.
Yes. They play a big role here, too. Instead of trying to find a buyer for just a small piece of a stake, which can be complicated and time-consuming, investors often decide it's easier to just sell their entire position to an intermediary, someone who specializes in these kinds of transactions.
So they're like a facilitator, a bridge between the sellers and the potential buyers in this market.
Exactly. They have the knowledge, the network, the expertise to handle these transactions smoothly. They can then find buyers for those assets, sometimes break them into smaller pieces to attract a wider pool of investors.
So it's counterintuitive, but a more consolidated market with those specialized intermediaries, it actually enhances liquidity in a way.
Precisely. It streamlines the whole ecosystem for these complex transactions. But here's where it gets really interesting. This dynamic also has major implications for that commitment quantity risk we discussed before.
Okay, so let's connect those dots. How does the secondary market, with its unique characteristics, tie back into that whole idea of commitment quantity risk?
Well, here's the thing. You'd think a more liquid secondary market would mitigate that risk, right?
Yeah, it seems like it would. If it's easier to exit, you're less worried about those market swings.
Right, but Gurrier, Phelipu, and Westerfield, they found that it doesn't always work that way. In fact, it can sometimes even amplify the risk.
Really?
Yeah, it's kind of a head-scratcher, isn't it?
It is, a little bit. I mean, if it's easier to get out, shouldn't investors be less concerned?
You'd think so, but here's the catch. When the secondary market is really active, really liquid, investors might feel more comfortable taking on those larger positions in private equity.
Because they see an easy out.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The exit risk feels lower, so they allocate more capital. But then, that's when the boomerang effect can happen.
Meaning?
The very liquidity that seemed to be mitigating the risk, it ends up amplifying it.
So greater liquidity, bigger allocations, and suddenly those market swings have a much bigger impact on their portfolio.
Exactly. It's this weird paradox, but it highlights how crucial it is to really grasp the complexity of this commitment quantity risk. You can't just rely on the secondary market as some sort of safety net.
Yeah, it's not a get out of jail free card.
Nope.
Okay, that's really interesting. It's a good reminder that even with exit options, you still need a well-thought-out strategy and a deep understanding of how the market works. Now, switching gears slightly, I wanted to go back to something we touched on earlier, which is diversification. It's often held up as this fundamental risk management tool, but our research, including the study by Gourier, Phelipu, and Westerfield, suggests it might not be as straightforward as it seems when we're talking about private equity. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, you're hitting on a really important point. The classic advice, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Yeah, it makes sense in a lot of situations. But with private equity, specifically managing that commitment quantity risk, well, diversification across multiple funds, it helps, but it doesn't completely eliminate the risk.
Okay, that's interesting. Why wouldn't spreading your commitments across different funds with different managers, different strategies, why wouldn't that fully mitigate the risk?
Because while diversifying that way might even out your cash flows, which is good, it doesn't protect you from those broader market swings. And remember, those swings, those are at the heart of commitment quantity risk. They can make your commitment feel huge or tiny overnight. And it doesn't matter which fund you're in, they're all affected.
So even if you've diversified your investments, a major market downturn can still impact the overall value of those commitments.
Exactly. It shows how interconnected everything is. Diversification helps, but it's not a cure-all in this case. Investors really need to understand that and maybe consider a broader approach to managing their private equity exposure.
It seems like successfully navigating the world of private equity, these capital commitments, it requires a delicate balance. You need to understand the opportunities, be aware of the risks, and accept that some of those traditional investment strategies might need a bit of tweaking for this particular asset class. It makes you wonder, if you could just hit rewind, redesign the whole system for investing in private equity, what would that even look like?
It's a question that has been debated for years. I mean, would you get rid of capital commitments altogether? Mm-hmm. Would you lose some of the benefits they bring by doing that? Or maybe there's a hybrid approach. Something that keeps the good parts of commitments, but gives investors more flexibility, more control to adjust when the market changes. Maybe a system where those commitments are dynamic, adjusting based on, you know, certain triggers, or mechanisms that allow for smoother scaling. There are definitely possibilities. The ideal solution, well, it probably depends on the individual investor, their needs, their risk tolerance. But one thing's for sure, the conversation about innovation and private equity, how we structure these commitments, it's definitely ongoing.
Yeah, there's definitely room for creativity here. It seems like there's always more to learn. And as our listeners know, the deep dive is all about giving you the knowledge and insights you need to navigate these complex topics. Today, we've really gone deep into the world of capital commitments. We've talked about how they work, their implications, and how they impact investors. We've unpacked some academic research, broken down some pretty complex ideas, and hopefully sparked some insightful conversations along the way.
And remember, knowledge is power, especially in the world of finance, which is constantly changing. We encourage you to keep digging into the research, keep asking those questions, and make sure you're approaching these investment decisions with a clear and informed perspective.
From blind pools to secondary markets, from commitment quantity risk to the evolving role of diversification, we've covered a lot of ground today. As always, thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. We'll be back soon with more fascinating topics to explore.